Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident, and this will be episode 125 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be continuing my rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This will be series 6, and I'm going to be focusing strictly on internal medicine with this podcast, because again, internal medicine is the bulk of the exam. So let's get going. Okay. So let's assume you get a question about a patient, and this patient, over the last 3 days, they've been having like mental status changes. Let's say it's like a young person or something, right? Like mental status changes. They've been having, they're just kind of weird. Like their close acquaintances are like, this is not him, right? Like mental status changes. The person is kind of like obtunded, and the person is not an alcoholic, right? And then they show you like, they tell you, okay, that you obtain like a CSF studies, right? And in that CSF study, you see like a ton of red blood cells. What are you thinking about? I really, really hope that under those circumstances, you're thinking about herpes, right? Like HSV encephalitis, right? So remember, HSV, right, it likes to cause, like classically on MBMEs, it presents in multiple different ways, right? So it can present as like encephalitis or meningitis in a newborn, right? And again, classically, when you do CSF studies, you notice that there are very high levels of red blood cells in the CSF. Although you kind of want to be careful there, right? So HSV, the problem will be more of like, oh, over the past 24 hours or over the past, 48 hours, this person has been out of it, versus a subarachnoid hemorrhage that can also present in a somewhat, I've seen MBME questions that they write in very similar ways where the person has like a subarachnoid hemorrhage and they come with no core rigidity, right? Don't be tricked. A person that has a subarachnoid hemorrhage, it'll be something that probably started like 2 or 3 hours ago, right? It will look like meningitis, but it started 2 or 3 hours ago. That'll be the clue that, maybe this is not necessarily a meningitis, right? Because again, HSV and subarachnoid hemorrhage, those are two high yield things. In fact, those are probably the two, like only two things other than a bloody CSF tap that can cause elevated red blood cells from a lumbar puncture on an MBME exam. So those are sort of kind of high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. Okay, and remember that HSV, right, what are some other classic things HSV can do, right? So HSV, right, can cause like encephalitis in the temporal lobes. So if you're describing a person that has encephalitis and they come in with like a seizure presentation, right, or they have issues in the temporal lobe, so they show you like something, like anything that relates in any way, shape or form to the temporal lobe on an MBME exam, that should really get you thinking about temporal lobe encephalitis from HSV. Okay, now remember another high yield temporal lobe relationship you want to keep in mind for exams is that most seizures start in the temporal lobe. Okay, so on EEG there are specific patterns that neurologists can actually identify that show them, oh yeah, this seizure is coming from the temporal lobe. Okay, so that's something else you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then remember that the medial temporal lobe, okay, if you have like increased intracranial pressure from, like a brain bleed or something, and you have high intracranial pressures, as pressure is building up, the medial part of your temporal lobe, known as the oncus, can herniate, right? That's the thing that's known as the transtentorial herniation, and that can compress cranial nerve 3, right? So those people will have like, classically, they'll have like a down and out eye, right? Because when you compress cranial nerve 3, you'll essentially have function left with, you'll essentially have the remaining cranial nerves that innervate the extraocular muscles of the eye acting unopposed, right? So for example, those people who have like a down and out eye. So why does the down and out eye happen? Remember, essentially every extraocular muscle is innervated by cranial 3, with the exception of superior oblique, which is done by cranial 4, that's your trochlear nerve, and lateral rectus, which is done by the abducens nerve, which is cranial nerve 6. So if the abducens nerve is working unopposed, the person's eye will deviate out, right? Because your lateral rectus muscle abducts the eye, right? And then their eye will go down because remember the superior oblique muscle, its job is to depress the eye, right? The eyeball, right? So those people's eyes are depressed, right? So that's why their eyes are down and out. And they will also classically have a blown pupil, right? The reason they have that blown pupil is, again, remember that cranial nerve 3, right? Through this whole business with the Edinger-Westphal nucleus, carries the fibers, like the parasympathetic fibers that deal with your eye, right? And remember, your parasympathetic system causes meiosis. So if, again, you've compressed cranial nerve 3 and you've knocked out its parasympathetic function, then the sympathetic function to the eye will act unopposed. And if that sympathetic function is acting unopposed, you'll have a mydriasis, okay? So those are classic findings in a transdentorial herniation. Another thing you may find in a transdentorial herniation is the person will have like ipsilateral upper motor neuron symptoms, because there's this thing known as a Kernighan's phenomenon, where when you have like a transdentorial herniation, you compress the midbrain. And when you compress the midbrain, like this is something that I cannot necessarily explain right now. It's something I'll probably explain in a different podcast, maybe more for people that are taking a step one. But basically, you can compress the contralateral cerebral peduncle. And if you compress the contralateral cerebral peduncle, right? Remember, cerebral peduncles are found in the midbrain, right? So let's say you have like a herniation of your left temporal lobe, right? A transdentorial herniation of your left temporal lobe. You will compress your right cerebral peduncle. When you compress your right cerebral peduncle, remember that your cerebral peduncle has a lot of your corticospinal tract fibers. So if you're compressing those, remember your corticospinal tract decussates at the level of the medullary pyramids, right? So those fibers in the right cerebral peduncle, they will cross to the left side at the level of the medullary pyramids, and then they will go and innervate muscles on the left side of the body, right? So you'll notice that the person will have upper motor neuron symptoms that are ipsilateral to the side where they had the onco herniation. That is something that is floridly high yield to know for MBME exams. Okay, so again, I know I sort of started on herpes, but I kind of ended at a transdentorial herniation. But again, this review is designed to be integrative. And then what if you get a question about a person that works in a prison, or like a TSA agent, or a person that has is like an IV drug user of some sort, and then they tell you that this person, you know, over the last 2 weeks, they've been losing weight, they've been having night sweats, they've been having like hemoptysis and all that stuff. And then let's say they show you like some kind of chest x-ray or some CT scan, some kind of lung imaging, and you're finding like hilar adenopathy, and you're finding like white around like the one of the upper lobes, like a cavitary lesion potentially in the upper lobes. What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about TB. Okay, TB, right? So remember, TB, right? Again, if you're a person that works in like a public environment, right? So like, oh, a person that works with prisoners, or a person that works at an airport, for example, right? Or a person that has risky behaviors that could give them HIV, like being an IV drug user. Those are all things that can essentially have associations with TB on MBME exams, right? And again, if a person has TB, right, how do you make the diagnosis, right? Usually on an MBME, the first thing you do is you do like, if a person has like the classic symptoms like the, the hemoptysis, night sweats, weight loss, and you have a very high suspicion, or it's an immigrant. Remember, immigrants also get TB quite frequently on MBME exams. If you see all those things, right, usually you want to like get the sputum and do like serial acid fast stains, right? But let's assume like, oh, on an MBME exam, you suspected like in an outpatient or whatever, you can do like a TB skin test, right? You can do a TB skin test. You'll find the induration, and hopefully you remember like the indurative values, right, for different people, right? So like if your induration is more than 15 millimeters, you have TB. It doesn't matter what you have, whether you're healthy, unhealthy, whatever. It doesn't matter. You have TB for sure. But if you're like a HIV patient or like an IV drug user, the cutoff for those people is 5 millimeters. Okay, it's 5 millimeters. And then if, for example, you're a healthcare worker, right? So like you're a resident or you're a physician or whatever, then the cutoff value is 10 millimeters. Okay, so those are all things you kind of need to keep at the back of your mind. And if you have a positive PPD skin test, what is always your next step? you want to make sure you go ahead and get a chest x-ray, right? Because if you see active lesions on a chest x-ray, that tells you you have like raging bad TB, right? Like active TB that needs to be treated. Or if you have a negative chest x-ray, that tells you that you have latent TB, right? And how do we treat latent TB? We treat latent TB with isoniazid for how many months? For 9 months, right? You treat it with isoniazid for 9 months. And in addition to that, what's the vitamin you try to supplement? I really hope you're telling me vitamin B6, right? Remember, vitamin B6 is also known as pyridoxine or pyridoxal phosphate. So by giving that vitamin, you prevent the neuropathy that is associated with a person taking isoniazid. Because remember, isoniazid depletes your levels of vitamin B6. And if you deplete vitamin B6, there are certain high-yield enzymes in the body that stop working. One classic one is a glutamate decarboxylase. Remember, glutamate decarboxylase converts glutamate to GABA. So if, and it uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor. So if you deplete B6 because you're taking isoniazid and you decide to not listen to your physician, right? You deplete your B6, glutamate decarboxylase doesn't work. So you have decreased conversion of glutamate to GABA. Okay, so your glutamate will build up, and with that in mind, you'll have seizures, right? Because remember, glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter versus GABA, that is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. Now, another enzyme that may not necessarily work as well is ALA synthase, right? So delta amino levolenic acid synthase. Remember, that is the rate limiting enzyme. I mean, many people know it as ALAS. That is the rate limiting enzyme in the synthesis of heme. Okay, so remember that enzyme uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor. It's like it takes B6 as a cofactor and then marries succinyl-CoA and glycine, and then boom, you have this happy marriage and you make a delta amino levolenic acid. So if again you're taking isoniazid without listening to your physician, your B6 pool is depleted, right? You won't be able to make heme and you'll get a sideroblastic anemia. Okay, that's actually the mechanism behind sideroblastic anemia being something that happens in people that take isoniazid. And then, kind of as a throwback to step one that can show up as like a bizarre question on NBME exams, remember that isoniazid can cause drug-induced lupus, right? So don't forget that association with your antihistona antibodies. And then you also kind of want to keep at the back of your mind that isoniazid, right? Like you can get like it has this relationship with like the slow and fast acetylator business. So they may present it to you as a bimodal curve on an NBME exam. Okay, like people that metabolize isoniazid differently, they are slow acetylators, they are fast acetylators, right? And again, if a person has latent TB, 9 months of isoniazid plus vitamin B6. If a person has active TB, right, you treat them for 6 months, but the first 2 months you give them the ripe regimen, right? So the ripe regimen is like rifampin, right? Isoniazid, pyrazinamide, and ethambutol, right? And then again, you also take vitamin B6. And again, it's kind of high yield to know some key things with those drugs. Before I talk about those, remember, you use ripe for 2 months, and then you use rye for 4 months, right? So the first 2 months of your 6 months of therapy, you use the ripe regimen plus vitamin B6. And then the last 4 months, you use rye, so rifampin and isoniazid plus B6 for the remaining 4 months to make up 6 months total. Now, the thing is, so that's for active TB versus latent TB, where it's 9 months of isoniazid plus vitamin B6. Now, here's the deal. Rifampin, what are the key toxicities with rifampin? Well, I hope you're telling me like a hepatotoxicity, right? Remember, rifampin is basically essentially all the TB drugs for the most part. If you want to remember fewer things, most of the TB drugs are hepatotoxic. So rifampin is hepatotoxic. And remember, it also causes like orange secretions, orange tears, orange vaginal fluid, orange urine and all that crap, right? And then you should remember that rifampin on NBMEs can actually be used to treat leprosy, right? Leprosy, there's like, it's almost like triple therapy for leprosy. You can remember with the mnemonic DRC, right? So the D stands for dapsone, the R stands for rifampin, and then the C stands for clofazimine. Okay, those three drugs are used to treat the Mycobacterium leprae. And then remember, if a person is a close contact of some dude or some lady that has Neisseria meningitidis, right? If you're a close contact, you can prophylax that close contact person with rifampin. Remember, there are three drugs you can use under those circumstances. You can use rifampin, or you can use ceftriaxone, or you can use ciprofloxacin, right? But I mean, you've heard me say this ad nauseum in multiple podcasts. The preferred agent is rifampin. However, if it's a patient that is pregnant, right? Remember, rifampin is a teratogen. And remember that ciprofloxacin is also a teratogen, right? It can cause like tendon problems in the fetus. So under those circumstances, if you have a pregnant patient, the drug of choice for close contact prophylaxis for Neisseria meningitidis is ceftriaxone. Remember, ceftriaxone is a third generation of cephalosporin. Now, isoniazid, right? I already talked about it. Isoniazid is nephrotoxic, right? It's neurotoxic, that peripheral neuropathy. And it's also hepatotoxic. And again, I've sort of talked about the neurotoxicity with the seizures, right? And an easy way to remember that, you may be like, Divine, this is so much detail. How do I remember all this? Just remember, many people know the symbol for isoniazid. It's I-N-H, right? So remember the I meaning isoniazid, the N meaning neurotoxic, and the H meaning hepatotoxic. So isoniazid is neurotoxic and hepatotoxic. And then remember pyrazinamide, I'm just going to let that go. They don't really test the side effects of those. And then ethambutol, remember it can cause vision problems, right? It can cause like a certain kind of color blindness, okay? So those are things to keep in mind. And then before I sign off here with TB, remember TB can also cause problems in the vertebral bodies, right? That's what's known as Pott's disease, right? And if they tell you that a person has meningitis and they have enhancement at the base of the brain, very high yield enhancement at the base of the brain, also think about TB. Under those circumstances, right? And remember that if a person has TB, right, TB will cause, if you're looking at like CSF in a person that has TB, the CSF studies of a person that has TB, right, you'll see like elevations in the person's like lymphocytes, okay? Even if TB is a bacterial infection, you have a response with lymphocytes. So you have like elevated lymphocytes, elevated protein, decreased glucose, the works, okay? And you have high CSF opening pressures. Those are very high yield things to know, right? And remember, having a negative TB skin test does not rule out TB, right? Having a negative TB skin test does not rule out TB. Remember, there are certain people that can have false negative TB skin tests, right? So people with sarcoidosis, for example, can have false negative TB skin tests. People with HIV can have false negative TB skin tests. People that are on steroids, people that are immunosuppressed, they can have false negative TB skin tests. So if you have the right clinical suspicion on an MBME or even in the real world, and the TB skin test is negative, that absolutely positively does not rule out TB, okay? That's a very high yield thing you want to keep in mind for the MBME exams. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a person that has, kind of question can I make up here? Okay, so what if you get a question about a patient, and this patient, they tell you that they have these, like, sores under their like their armpits, right? So like the I guess I shouldn't use the word armpit, I'm a physician, so let me use the more appropriate medical term, axilla, right? So a person has sores and all that crap under their axilla, right? And it's like a chronic problem, it hurts, those things hurt a ton. What's your diagnosis? That is what? That's hidradenitis suppurativa, right? That's hidradenitis suppurativa. And what is the kind of gland that is inflamed in hidradenitis suppurativa? Those are your apocrine glands. Okay, again, very high yield to know those. Those are your apocrine glands. Contrast this with your sebaceous glands, right, that are inflamed in acne. Okay, and remember those hidradenitis, there's really no good treatment, right? Those people really need to, that's why you see hidradenitis show up a lot on surgery shelf exams. It's a surgical problem. It's something that you fix by literally chopping out all those abscesses and stuff. So surgical treatment is what you do for hidradenitis suppurativa. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a patient, you know, let's say they are obtunded, like they have some risk factor that may make them obtunded. So let's say they are alcoholics, for example, right? Or let's say it's like an old person falls down, cannot get up. And then they tell you that this person's creatinine is now very high. What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about rhabdo, right? Rhabdomyolysis. Again, if you notice, I've probably mentioned the diagnosis rhabdomyolysis in like maybe like 10 or 15 different podcasts that I've made over the life of my website. The reason I say it is rhabdomyolysis shows up on pretty much any notable MBME-based exam that you ever take. And for whatever bizarre reason, people still get rhabdo questions wrong all the time. So rhabdo is very high yield. It will just be a person that has some risk factor for being obtunded. Alcoholic, it's almost always an alcoholic on MDMEs. But it can be a person that, again, old person falls down, cannot get up. Or it can be a person that just ran a marathon, right? Or it can be a person that has like a crush injury from trauma. Those things all cause rhabdomyolysis, right? Well, why are you worried with rhabdo? The reason you're worried with rhabdo is that it can torch your kidneys, right? It can be a cause of ATN. It can cause acute tubular necrosis. And usually in an MBME question, if a person has rhabdo, right? Classically, they will show you that, oh, when you look at this person's urine, you see like 3 or 4 plus blood, like some ridiculous amount of blood. On dipstick, right? But when you do microscopy, you're like, man, I'm seeing only like 1 or 2 red blood cells. What's up with that? If you see that, right? So like urine that is positive for blood by dipstick, but is negative for red blood cells. When you see that on microscopy, or you see like very few red blood cells on microscopy, that's pathognomonic for rhabdomyolysis on an MBME exam. Okay. And again, how do you treat rhabdo, right? You fluids. Give people a crap ton of fluids. I mean, these people can get up to like a liter of like normal saline every 4 hours. Okay. To tell you how bad rhabdo can be, you're trying to wash out that myoglobin from their urinary tract. And then remember that rhabdo, right? Or your friends at the MBME, they occasionally love to test some electrolyte abnormalities that you may find in a patient with rhabdo, right? So those people could have like hypocalcemia. Remember, those dead muscles can sequester that calcium. So that can present as like a prolonged QT interval in an MBME question. Those people can also get hyperkalemia. Remember, your sodium potassium ATPase pump puts 3 sodiums outside of cells and puts 2 potassiums into cells, right? So potassium is primarily an intracellular ion. So if your muscle cells explode, they release their cell soap into the surroundings. That can cause a hyperkalemia. Okay, and remember, that can manifest on an EKG as like peaked T waves, so tall peak T waves, YQRS complexes. If the K continues to rise, right, they will have like the sine wave EKG. And then after that, they will go into like asystole, right, like a flat line. So hopefully you remember from my medicine reviews where I talk about, oh, doing things like calcium gluconate, right, to stabilize the myocardium, or doing things like insulin with glucose, right, to lower their potassium, or doing things like albuterol, beta 2 agonist, to help with lowering their potassium. Or inducing an alkalosis, right? Like giving sodium bicarb. Remember, if you induce an alkalosis, that will pull hydrogen ions out of cells and potassium will go in reverse, right? Or you can do things like diuresis with furosemide. Remember, furosemide is a loop diuretic. Loops cause hypokalemia as a side effect. So that can help you. You give those patients fluids and then you diurese them at the same time with furosemide. That will help them get rid of that excess potassium. And then another thing you can do is you can give K-exalate. Remember, K-exalate makes K exit out of your body, okay? So those are all things you can do for hyperkalemia. Again, very high yield to know on exams. And then remember, there's a drug overdose that can present as wide QRS complexes on an MBME. What drug overdose am I going after here? Kind of looks like hyperkalemia. Think about it like psych. Let's assume it's a psych question. That'll be a TCA, right? That'll be a tricyclic antidepressant. Okay, good. So, I guess let's go ahead and move on. So let me maybe talk about one more case because I want to keep this under 30 minutes. Let's see. I guess, what if you get a question about I'll make this an easy question because it's like a big general concept I want to talk about. So what if you get a question about a person that, you know, has a pretty, you know, significant allergy history? Right? And then they tell you that they have like, you know, episodic like wheezing and all that crap. What are you thinking about? That's asthma, right? Asthma is what type of hypersensitivity reaction? It's a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction, right? And remember, your type 1 hypersensitivity reactions, basically the thing that happens is you get that first exposure to like some antigen, and then your body is like, ooh, okay. Your antigen presenting cells, like your B cells, macrophages, they pick that up, they present it to T cells. You have this whole weirdness with class switching that happens. So maybe like interleukin 4 sort of like holds sway, and you class switch from like IgM to IgE, right? And then that IgE just lies in wait on the surfaces of like your eosinophils, your mast cells, and stuff like that. And then when you have the second exposure to the antigen, right? That antigen binds to those IgEs. You have cross-linking of the constant regions, and boom, everything gets bad, right? You begin to have like wheezing and all that crap, right? So that's the pathophysiology behind type 1 hypersensitivity reactions. Those things arise, they are mediated by IgE, mast cells, and eosinophils, okay? And classic examples of those things are things like asthma, right? Asthma is a classic one. Allergies, right? Any kind of allergy, right? Even like on medicine, MBMEs, for whatever reason, they love like allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, right? Those things can all present as type 1 hypersensitivity reactions. Another thing that can also, and remember, allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, right? You may see like a fungus ball in the lung. In fact, sometimes those fungus balls look like lung cancer. So usually you'll want to like biopsy those things, right? Just to make sure that it's not cancer, because you don't have like some crystal ball that tells you, oh, you know what, this is a fungus ball, this is aspergillus. No, you really can't make that call, right? So you still need to biopsy those things. And then, so that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And then if you're thinking about like a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, right? So you're thinking about making antibodies. So it's like B cell mediated, antibody mediated. You're making antibodies against fixed antigens. Like you're almost always making antibodies against like a cell type in your body. So take, for example, if you make antibodies against your red blood cells, so like an autoimmune hemolytic anemia, that's an example of a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. Or if you make antibodies against like GP2B3A, like in ITP, that's an example of a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. Notice, you're making antibodies against cells, okay? Or if you make antibodies against like your follicular cells, right? Like antibodies, like stimulating antibodies against like the follicular cells of your thyroid gland, right? Like the TSH receptor, Graves' disease, that's an example of a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. Now, type 3, right? Those are your antigen antibody complexes, right? So classically, you're thinking about things like, you're thinking about things like the nephritic syndromes, right? Like post-streptococcal or post-infectious glomerulonephritis, right? You form an antigen antibody complex. I kind of think of it as like two people partner up together. They show up somewhere, they wreak havoc, right? So same thing here. Antigen antibody complex, they go, like they show up in places like your joints, your kidneys and stuff like that. And then remember that antibody part, especially like if it's like IgM or IgG, those things can activate the classic complement cascade. So you have all this inflammation and then you destroy stuff. Okay, those are your type 3 hypersensitivity reactions. And then your type 4 hypersensitivity reactions, right? Those are classically things like, those are things like, it's called like your delayed type hypersensitivity reaction. So like contact dermatitis, poison ivy, right? The delayed TB skin test, right? Those are all examples of type 4 hypersensitivity reactions. And those for the most part are mediated by like your T cells and macrophages, okay? It's a delayed type hypersensitivity reaction, right? So again, those are all like key high yield examples. Those are all examples of your hypersensitivity reactions, right? So again, keep those things at the back of your mind. Another weird one that they love to test on MBMEs is like, say for example, a person has like a hypersensitivity pneumonitis, right? That's actually an example of a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction, right? So if for example, you get a question about a person that has like, you know, like has birds or is a farmer, like you probably remember this as like bird fancier's lung, right? Those things can, because think about it, you're making antibodies against like a particular antigen. The antigen is the stuff, the organic whatever that you inhale, right? Like bird poop, bird secretions, whatever, okay? Hypersensitivity pneumonitis is an example of a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction. It arises in the setting of like an antigen antibody complex, right? And remember, hopefully, I really, really do hope that you remember that those are hypersensitivity pneumonitis are associated with like a thermophilic actinomycetes, okay? That's a very high yield factoid you want to lock in your brain for MBME exams, right? It can arise from, like many people are like used to like, oh, I'm exposed to a bird or whatever, I'm in a barn or whatever, and this causes hypersensitivity pneumonitis. That's not the only thing that can cause it, right? It can happen in a question that almost looks like Legionella, right? So they may describe a person that is like close to like a warm spring or a hot tub or something, right? And then they tell you that this person seems to have like episodic symptoms. It's like, oh, they have exposure to this thing. They come back, they have like this thing that writes for like a couple of days. Like they're like, ah, I have cough, I have wheezing. You listen to their lungs, you're hearing like what looks like almost like fibrotic lung disease. If you see those things, also think about hypersensitivity pneumonitis, okay? Because the thing is, they will have exposure to something and then they will have like episodic lung symptoms. That's the thing that will lead you towards hypersensitivity pneumonitis as your diagnosis on an NBME. And I don't know, since I mentioned the word hot tub. So hot tub seems to be a hot topic these days on NBME exams, right? So the thing is, basically, there are three things that you can test with hot tubs on an NBME. One is hypersensitivity pneumonitis, right? Like again, exposure to hot tubs, episodic, very high yield. Notice I keep saying episodic, episodic, episodic. I'm not saying it because I love to say the word episodic. I'm saying it because it's very high yield to know for exams. Episodic symptoms, think about hypersensitivity pneumonitis. Think about your thermophilic actinomycetes. But another thing that may present in the context of a hot tub is something called hot tub lung, right? So classically, this will be a question about a person. It's usually like a female on NBMEs, and they'll tell you that they've had like, just, man, they just have like chronic, like low level infection for like 3 weeks, like low level lung infection for like 3 weeks. And maybe they've again been exposed to like hot tubs. If you see that, think about like MAC, like Mycobacterium avium intracellulari, or like the Mycobacterium avium complex. Those things are associated with hot tubs, and they tend to cause like long-standing pulmonary infection. And the thing is, it's almost always in a female. And here is one telltale sign that you are likely dealing with hot tub lung from Mycobacterium avium on an exam. They will classically put it in a patient that is not immunocompromised. Okay. Yes, it can show up in patients with HIV, but that would not be the, that will usually not be the patient demographic you would see on an NBME exam. And then the final thing that relates to hot tubs on NBMEs is if you see a person that uses hot tubs a lot and they have a rash, right? That's hot tub folliculitis, right? That's, you should really be thinking about Pseudomonas under those circumstances. So hot tub folliculitis, think about Pseudomonas. And really, how do you treat hot tub lung from Mycobacterium avium intracellulari? You give a macrolide, okay? You give a macrolide. Remember, macrolides can prolong the QT interval, right? And remember that erythromycin, right? The macrolide, it's a motilin receptor agonist, right? So it can cause diarrhea as a side effect. You can actually use that side effect in the treatment of a diabetic gastroparesis, right? And remember that if you're exposed to erythromycin in the first few weeks of life, that can increase your risk of hypertrophic pyloric stenosis, right? Where you see like a newborn, maybe like a firstborn male, who knows, with like non-bilious vomiting and like a palpable mass in the epigastrium, right? Those are the classic ways those things are present. So I feel like I have more things to say, but let's just go ahead and stop here. Again, this is supposed to be a rapid review. So I do hope you get a lot from this podcast, as I do whenever I end every podcast. I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one, 2CK, 2CS, step three. I've done this with thousands and thousands of people that have been very successful. And then if you're a college student and you need tutoring for like physics, gen chem, ochem, biochem, histology, physiology, I do offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you're also like a medicine resident and you're preparing for like your internal medicine in training exam or the internal medicine board exams, I do offer tutoring for those. And then if you're a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCASAP, or a med student applying to residency, like an ERASAP, so like personal statements, preparing applications and all that stuff, I do offer like one-on-one advising for that. Again, I've worked with tons of people, and most of the people I worked with this past admission cycle, most of them actually matched at their first choices. Pretty much everyone I worked with matched into the specialty of their choosing. And I mean, right now I'm working with tons of people that are applying with this current ERASA cycle. So if you need help with any of those things, reach out to me either through the website, or you can send me a personal email to, you can send an email to Divine Intervention Podcasts, podcast with an S at the end, at gmail.com. So I wish you all the very best. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you, and I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.